I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, we celebrate the career, the 60-year career of French pioneer filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard as the IFI announce a two-month retrospective. Is the future of TV on YouTube? The Oscars and the BBC seem to think so, and I talk to YouTube producer Molly MacDonald about the evolution of online TV. Plus, Niamh O'Reilly is here with all the week's new releases, including the scary monkey movie, Primate. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. And I do hope you are doing well. And of course, there are big schedule changes on News Talk next week, but I'm delighted to tell you that I'm not changing at all. It's 6 p.m. every Saturday is the regular time for this show. And so it will continue. And so say all of us. Well, so say me. I hope you're well. I hope you survived the storms. Well, the storm, Chandra. It was pretty wet where I was. Had a funny one on Tuesday when we were, I suppose, in the eye of the storm. I was picking up the kids from two of them who were in primary school. And the road in front of the school was flooded, and it kind of crept up the flood in terms of the road. So I parked the car and I was walking up, and I came to this part where it was about 3 feet deep, the flood. And I thought, how am I going to, like, have to get my kids? How am I going to get through this? So I was about to, you know, just wade through it in my jeans and jacket. And then a guy came out of his house and said, just walk through my garden, walk through all the gardens. And I said, are you sure? He said, yeah, that's what everyone's doing. So thank you to that kind man who told me to walk through his and indeed his neighbor's gardens. And that's what I did. I hopped about five walls, waving at people saying sorry, and got to the other side of the flood. I was like a benign house burglar. So that was my highlight or low light. Well, it was definitely a highlight. Such human decency where strangers tell you, walk through my garden and don't get wet. It's that kind of pleasant thinking we need in this day and age. But I do hope you're dry wherever you are. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
If you have any communication devices on you, phones, tablets, I want you to take them out. I want you to hold them high in the air above your head. Do it now. Once you have your phones in the air above your head, I want you to move slowly towards the conference room this way.
When you get to the conference room,
move.
I need you to put your devices move. In this grey bin, one by one.
Move.
Ooh, in the air!
Above your head.
One by one.
If you have phones, put them in the air.
You heads!
Ladies and gentlemen, if you do exactly what I say when I say it, you won't get hurt. If you don't do what I say when I say it, you will be shot.
Yes, that is a clip. Here's a heist for you from the movie Steel, which is on Prime Video. They used to call it Amazon Prime, but they want to call Prime Video now, it seems, or even sometimes Prime, it seems. Not to be mistaken with that very sugary drink. But this is on Prime Video, and it stars the great Sophie Turner, who was, of course, very famous from Game of Thrones. And she plays Zara, who's kind of a low-level worker in a big finance company, and the big finance company look after pension funds. And this show begins with a brilliant heist. It's really well done because it's this gang of pretty scary people who have guns and prosthetics, and they get into this high finance company, and they're on the 13th floor or whatever it is, high up above London, right near the Gherkin. And Zara is tasked with basically her and a friend of hers, Luke, who sits beside her, with carrying out this heist. And what the heist involves, this is not, you know, taking money from a safe or anything. It is the transfer of money with a few keystrokes. So she has to log in and basically put a few numbers in, and then £4 billion, which is meant to be for public sector workers' pensions, is transferred to some strange account or accounts. And that's how the show begins. Now, it isn't a spoiler to say that Zara, Sophie Turner's character, is somehow on some level possibly involved, because the trailer has that or intimates that. And it's 6 parts, so something has to happen. But that don't mean she's all bad either. She's a bit of a mess in her life, gets nosebleeds, and has a very complicated relationship with a kind of unpleasant mother. After the heist, everything goes haywire. We're not sure who's carrying out this heist. Is it just the baddies? Is it MI5? Is it the cops? Is it the government? And this is a pretty decent thriller, I have to say. We did it on Pat Kenny this week in Boxed, and Pat really enjoyed it as well. Occasionally stretches credulity, but, you know, that's occasionally the nature of these things. But I think this will really keep you going, because the plot goes in lots of interesting ways. She kind of eventually starts doing her own investigation into what's going on, and the intrigue heightens, and who's actually behind this massive heist or this stroke of a keyboard that's lost them £4 billion. There's a funny billionaire in it, played by the great Scottish actor Peter McMullen. This really works. Sophie Turner is brilliant in it. She is terrific as a woman who's falling apart, but also might be the smartest person in the room. And I really liked the ending. I thought the ending played out very well and had a kind of Die Hard vibe to it. So a pretty big thumbs up for Steel on Prime Video. 6 episodes, now streaming for your viewing pleasure. So let me know what you've been watching. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. And last week we had John Bishop, a lot of people commenting on the fact that I had to bring up Everton to him, as he's a lifelong Liverpool fan. Yes, I did. Of course I did. Always. As someone said to me, every interview you do, is there always a mention of Everton and Billy Joel? I think there might be. But hey, you love me just the way I am, or something like that. But let me know what you've been watching and what you've been thinking. Screentime@newstalk.com. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is Primate, a movie about a scary monkey. And the movie we were talking about slightly last week in the company of John Bishop, Is This Thing On?, where Will Arnett plays a fictionalized version, I suppose you might say, or some kind of version of John Bishop. Delighted to be joined by someone we haven't seen in a while, film buff Niamh O'Reilly. Niamh, hello.
How are you?
Good. Thank you for braving the inclement weather.
Yeah, I know. I need my waders on. It's been pretty bad this week, but yeah, we struggle on.
Indeed we do. Thank God for cinema. So, Primate. So this is, I wasn't being that glib, it's about a horror monkey, basically.
I mean, we could sort of leave the review there, John. Horror monkey goes mad.
Unfortunately, I'll have to say a bit more.
We're going to have to say a bit more. So yeah, this is called Primate, and it is very much... Well, I thought before I went into this, it was going for that kind of B-movie, schlocky sort of horror, unashamedly so. Fortunately, it didn't quite work for me. So the story is very simple. It is about a young girl called Lucy who is coming home from college somewhere in America, doesn't say where. She's flying home to Hawaii, of all places,
nice,
to see her family for the summer. And she brings a few friends with her. She gets home and we find out that her dad, who is played by Oscar winner Troy Kreutzer, by the way.
Fantastic in Coda,
yes,
recently in Black Rabbit.
Yes, so I had high hopes for this. So he plays her father. He's a novelist. And also at home is her younger sister.
And by the way, Troy is deaf. Playing a deaf person in everything
it's just
he plays.
Completely normal. Yeah, right. He is himself in this. So she gets home and we find out that the mother has died the year previous. And she was a very famous linguist, sort of world renowned, and had worked with primates and had more or less adopted a primate into the family. His name is Ben. So he's sort of part pet, part adopted child into the family. Okay. Like, he has a t-shirt on and he's able to use a tablet.
And had the mother studied him from a linguistic point
of
view?
Yes, she had. Yeah, very close. And very close to the family, like almost blurring the lines between sibling and pet.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but very intelligent, can use sign language, can converse with everybody, has a tablet, can tap the right things. So very smart chimp. So she gets home and unfortunately the dad has to go off for the weekend, leaving the teens / young adults at home with the chimp, which normally would be fine, except at the start of the film, we see that poor Ben has been bitten by a mongoose who has rabies. So okay. Ben now has rabies and Ben is left with the teenagers for a weekend in a very secluded house on the side of a cliff in a forest in Hawaii.
Okay.
What could go wrong, John?
And so Ben is bitten by a mongoose, which gives him rabies. So does that mean Ben just goes crazy, or is there a supernatural element?
There's no supernatural. This is like, I'm going back a bit now, but people might remember Cujo.
Oh, yeah.
So about a rabid dog.
Yeah.
This is kind of like Cujo for the...
A rabid dog as opposed to a rabbit.
A rabbit,
dog,
yeah. Rabies.
Yeah.
So he just has rabies. So, it turns him into a total lunatic who wants to rip everybody's faces off.
Okay.
And that is pretty much the story here. And there's nothing wrong with a simple story. Don't get me wrong. Mm. In fact, I think we've so much elevated horror now.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice to have something that is what it is. And just is going to be, you know, a film about a chimp going bananas. I didn't actually mean to do that.
Brilliant.
There you go, I'm on a roll. But for me, there's a difference between like a simple premise and a very flat script.
Mm.
And the script here, you feel like Ben, the chimp, might have written the script. It's that flat. It's that one-dimensional. And the pacing is a big problem here. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some fantastic scenes of gore. It starts off very strong. Like, if you have a weak stomach, be warned. There's lots of gore in this.
Okay. And but it's practical effects, largely, I gather.
It is practical effects,
and it's a real chimpanzee?
Well, it is a performer. It's not an AI chimp. So from that point of view, it's really refreshing.
It's corporeal form,
though. It's corporeal, absolutely. And you really get the sense of how strong chimps are. I mean, when he attacks, you almost feel the thuds on your own chest. Like, so it's not AI and it's not light. It's very, very visceral. And the scenes where he is attacking, they are quite scary. You know, chimps, wonderful animals, very intelligent. But even if you watch a nature program, you can see in the wild when they go for someone, it's scary and it's full on and it's very difficult to stop them. So from that point of view, it works very well. But the pacing was a big problem. For me, there are large chunks of this film where nothing happens and it's extremely boring. I just felt, is anything going to happen? And because the script is just feels so one-dimensional, we don't really care. We don't get enough run-up to care about these teenage characters, and we don't really get enough stuff to care about Ben either. And we should have sympathy with Ben because he's supposed to be this loved family pet / almost adopted child, but this is all sort of told in a little bit of exposition in the titles, in the opening titles. So we don't get to learn more about Ben or his relationship or even any more about the teenagers / young adults in this. And I think it's to its detriment because when things start happening to them, we don't really care.
Okay.
In fact, there's a couple of characters introduced midway through this film and I'm sort of hoping, I was hoping that Ben would rip their faces off. they were that irritating. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a few moments of levity in here and there's a couple of very funny scenes which work really well. I think if they had leaned into that a little bit more would have helped. I just feel like it took itself too seriously for what it is.
Okay. Now, it's funny you say that nothing was happening at times and it was slow. It's only 89 minutes. So I had the sense this would bristle along.
Me too.
I guess
like I said, there's nothing wrong with a short, simple, you know, horror film that knows what it is and it's going to be bloody and it's going to be gory. But the pacing, like there are spells of this where, I'm not going to ruin it, but the teens are sort of trying to hide away from Ben, in a particular area of the house, which is quite well done. The premise is good, but it gets extremely boring.
Okay.
And there's no tension. There's no tension building up to these set pieces. So you're sort of like snoring away. And because you don't care that much about the characters, there isn't enough emotional sort of depth there. When these things do start happening to them, you just, it loses its impact for me. The pacing is just a big, big problem.
It's funny because you talked about elevated horror and in a way, and I haven't got to see this, but from what I read about it and what you're saying, it's being billed as a good old-fashioned practical effects animal turns evil, chases after people. What's not to like in the cold weather of January? But it's almost, it's gone to the other extreme. It's too simple.
It felt very flat. The script, there's nothing there. And there's no, like, you can have a simple film, but you need to have, you need to care, I think, about the characters. And they have to be more than just the one-dimensional. Like, they're very sort of the good teenager, you know, the sort of slightly slutty, inverted commas, teenager, the annoying teenager, the young, innocent one. And there's nothing wrong with leaning into stereotypes, but there's no kind of, I suppose, self-awareness or even humour to kind of back those up. It's very, what you see is what you get. I will say, there's a couple of nice nods to some horror classics in this. A scene taken straight out of Halloween and one out of the Scream franchise, which was quite nice. And I think maybe if they had of leaned into the sort of meta self-awareness side of things a bit more.
But that's not going to carry a whole movie, sure.
No, it isn't going to carry a whole movie. There's some good things in here. It's not a total disaster. And I think a younger audience is probably going to have an absolute blast at this because the gore is gory, you know, and there are a few moments where I can definitely see, you know, theatres, people jumping at certain moments and stuff, but there are periods in between that I found utterly boring.
Okay, fair enough. This monkey needs more bananas, clearly. So what we're talking about, Primate, which is in cinemas from this Friday, which is the 30th of January. Neve O'Reilly is lukewarm. What are you going to say stars-wise?
I'm going to be on the fence and say 2.5.
2.5, that's okay. Sounds about fair. We better take a flavour of the aforementioned Primate.
Lucy, bad. Bad. Bad.
Give me the phone. Try recent calls. Yes, it's ringing. Brad, listen to me. We need help.
Oh, you need some help?
Send some help. Go!
What's your emergency?
Here, just send the police.
Ma'am?
He found me.
That is a clip from Primate, which is in your local cinema. I was going to say local theatre, like an American.
Nice, yeah.
Local cinema, I prefer to say, as of this Friday, the 30th of January.
Probably our parents.
To the pictures. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Okay, so that was Primate, 2.5 stars. Now, last week I interviewed John Bishop about a movie that I found delightful called Is This Thing On?, where Will Arnett plays a kind of version of John Bishop, albeit in New York. Over to you, Neve, because you've seen it as well.
I have.
It's out this week, I should mention.
Yeah, and I have to say, out of these two films, when I was going to see them, I was less enthusiastic about Is This Thing On? I don't traditionally like these sorts of films. I think it's unfair to class it as a rom-com, but it was giving those sort of vibes to me, so I was not looking forward to it. I'd also had The Commute from Hell. So this film had an uphill battle to charm me. But charm me it did.
Excellent. Yeah. So remind people what it's about.
So as you said, it's loosely, very loosely based on how comedian John Bishop came to be kind of a comedian and sort of saved his marriage in the process. So it stars Will Arnett as Alex and his wife is Tess, played by the wonderful Laura Dern. They have wonderful chemistry. And the film opens with them. They're sort of a midlife couple, maybe sort of late 40s, early 50s. They have two children who are 8 and 9 or 9 and 10. And they just sort of very amicably decide to split. And the way in which the split happens, I thought was so refreshing. She is literally in the bathroom brushing her teeth and he just gets out of the shower and one of them says, do you think we should just call it? And when you're watching it, you're thinking, what are they talking about? Mm-hmm. It becomes clear very quickly. They're talking about their relationship. So there's no big argument. There's no inciting incident here. These are two people in midlife who have kind of lost their spark for each other. And I think kind of their spark for life as well. And they just decide very amicably to split. He doesn't even go down and sleep on the couch or leave that evening. They just say, look, we'll just go to bed and they sort everything out. So it kind of follows their journey and more Alex's journey rather than Tess's, really. She does get some time in this. But he moves into an apartment in the city. And one evening, I think he doesn't want to sit with his feelings, really, about how he's feeling about all of this.
And he's missing his kids.
And he's missing his kids and he's in an empty apartment, which is quite, you know, it's sad. So to avoid all that, he goes out into the town looking for a drink and stumbles along the to the Comedy Cellar, which is a famous institution in New York City. All of the greats started there. It's like a bit like the International Bar here. And he goes in, he doesn't want to pay. So he puts his name down because there's a cover charge.
Which is pretty much what happened to John Bishop in real life in Manchester.
Yeah. So they've taken that. So he doesn't want to pay, puts his name down, doesn't really know what he's putting his name down for, and finds himself up on stage and has to do a very short stand-up set. And he does it. And it's more like therapy for him. And he finds that actually he really enjoys this. And this is opening up something for him that he maybe was missing in his life. Mm. So it's kind of following his journey, leaning into this. But parallel to that, we do have sort of Tess, and we find out a little bit about her. She was a very high performing athlete. Mm. She performed in volleyball for the American team. She had to give all that up when she became a parent and a wife and stuff. So it's about two people, I suppose, trying to reconnect with their own lives and their own sense of self, but also perhaps come back as a couple or perhaps not. And that's really kind of it in a nutshell.
And we have Bradley Cooper, who directed it, playing his best friend, who is brilliant in this. If he had gotten a Best Supporting Nod, I wouldn't be offended.
I
thought he was hilarious.
Maybe not enough
screen time, but I thought he was hilarious.
He was very quirky in this. His character's name is Balls, as far as I can make out. And he's playing his pal, and they're friends in real life. You know? So that sort of warmth is there. And I think the film works so well for me because of partly because of the chemistry between Laura Dern and Will Arnett. It feels very lived in and very relatable and very real. And I think we're so used to seeing sort of rom-coms about, you know, young people, boy meets girl, and, you know, it's flashy and very unbelievable and fantasy. This felt so real.
Yeah.
This felt like it could be any of our lives, any of us who are in midlife. You've been married a really long time. You've a couple of kids. You're kind of maybe cheesed off with the grind of daily life. It's so easy to fall out of not exactly love with one another, but maybe love for your relationship with one another. And it was just done so well. There's no bust up. There's no, someone wasn't having an affair on someone. And I think it just felt so gritty and so real and so realistic. I just absolutely loved it. But I think also where the film's strength lie is in the comedy parts, because they use the Comedy Cellar, which is so famous, and they use real stand-ups as sort of, you know, the other comics in the bit parts. And also the directing, I don't know what you thought from Bradley Cooper, I thought was fantastic. Some of the choices he used for his shots, particularly when Alex is performing, like it's very close up on his face, or there was a wonderful shot of the camera was up in the eaves while he was down performing. Mm. And there is a scene in the film where, this probably isn't a spoiler to say because this is part of John Bishop's story, where Laura Dern goes to the Comedy Cellar not knowing that her ex, well, separated husband is up there performing.
Making jokes about her.
And it's a scene where if there was a pillow, I probably would have put it in front of me for the cringe factor. But the camera stays almost on her face for that entirety of that scene, which was really interesting.
Really well directed. Yeah. And those comedy scenes, like, they look great as well, but they're so well done because you're kind of cringing at times. Is he going to pull this off? Is he oversharing? Oh, thank God he's funny. Oh, he's not so funny tonight. I love this, I have to say.
I thought it was great. And you're right, it does kind of walk that line, because I think a lot of people, when they see the scenes of him in the Comedy Cellar, will think back to something like The Joker or even Baby Reindeer, you know, where you have comedians almost sort of falling flat on their faces, standing up there, and the lights are on them. And it's quite tense almost in a way. But it's lovely to see him kind of discover something for him again, and his lust for life, you know, and Tess also. I think Laura Dern is terrific in this.
She's absolutely terrific. And Will Arnett, I thought, was brilliant. And, sensitivity, and, you know, the kind of, you talked about, just his tired feeling of life, and that he's reached a cul-de-sac. He's great at
that. You know, there is a reckoning to be had, you know, in this film. It's not like sort of a Hollywood, you know, cookie cutter look at, you know, separation or reconciliation. There is a real reckoning, and you know, they really have to take accountability for what they maybe have done or not done.
And this isn't a spoiler, but what I loved about it was, it doesn't go into, if this is a comedian loosely based on John Bishop, him then playing Madison Square Garden or Three Arena, it keeps it as a human story about a man finding himself through comedy and possibly reconnecting with his wife.
I think that's why it works so well. It felt so real. Yeah. It doesn't feel pie in the sky, even though, I mean, John Bishop has gone on to, you know, stratospheric levels. This does keep it kind of pared back. But I will say, it felt a little bit unbelievable that someone from New York would not know that you arrive at the Comedy Cellar and you don't know that it's a place for stand-up. I just was like, I'm from Ireland and I know, I'm from Bray and I know that, you know, so that just felt, but look, they had to go with it for the story.
Absolutely. Let's not that get in the way. So what are you going to stay stars-wise for Is This Thing On, which is also in cinemas this Friday the 30th?
Four stars.
I'm in complete agreement with you. I would give it 4 stars as well. Greatly enjoyed it. So Niamh O'Reilly has been reviewing Is This Thing On, which is in cinemas on the 30th of January. She gave it 4 stars. I concur. And she was less enthused by Primate, all about a scary monkey that just isn't that scary. She gave 2.5 stars. She's off to buy a whole new round of bananas. Niamh O'Reilly, thank you very much. Niamh O'Reilly there, reviewing Primate and Is This Thing On. Up next, the cinematic powerhouse that was Jean-Luc Godard. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, Jean-Luc Godard contains multitudes. One of the most influential directors of all time and one of the leading lights of the French New Wave in the 1950s and 60s. If you don't believe me, only take note of the fact that the IFI are running a 24-film, 2-month retrospective, all dedicated to the movies of Jean-Luc Godard. In tandem with that, Richard Linklater's acclaimed Nouvelle Vague, a fictionalised and kind of wry look behind the scenes of Godard's first movie, Breathless, will be screened as part of this festival. I'm delighted to say that the head of cinema programming at the IFI, an old friend of the show, hasn't been on in a very long time, but that's my bad, Dave O'Mahony, joins me in studio now. Dave, hello, sir.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me back after all these years.
You never call. Listen, I said to you beforehand, you know, we need to be careful because I was going to say they can do college courses on Godard. They probably do. And we have about 15 minutes, right?
Well, this is it. Even as you were doing the introduction there and you said 24 films over 2 months, I started thinking, what are we doing? You know, and this really is a season that we've sort of put off for a long time. I certainly have
because of the scale of it.
Because of the scale and because of, I think I wrote in one of the notes, it's one of those, he's a director, it's difficult to get your arms around him, you know, because I liken him to, it's like Picasso. Do you like Picasso? Well, which era?
Yeah.
You know, Godard is very like that. Which era? Is it the fun stuff? Is it the stuff no one can understand? Or is it the bit in the middle? You know, it's...
What okay. Let's try and put our arms around it. And we're running out of time already. Yeah. We're down to 14 minutes. No. Yeah. But why is he so important? Is it because he had all these different phases or is it possible to put your finger on why he's so important?
That is certainly part of it, but I think it's his huge influence. He's probably one of the most influential people in cinema and beyond him in image making, if that doesn't sound too lofty. I mean, like, it sort of ripped up the rule book of narrative cinema in the 60s, kind of by accident and design. I mean, a lot of this was due to monetary constraints, things like that. Films have to, like, we talk about the iconic jump cuts, you know, we invented. A lot of that was due to, you know, not having very much film and having to move the story along and things like that. But he did rip up the rule book. He was involved in this incredibly exciting group of young filmmakers, all of whom were kind of film critics who wrote for Cahiers du Cinéma, and they all burst out, people like Agnès Varda.
The publication you mentioned there, did he found that?
No. He was a writer for it. Him and François Truffaut and a couple of Claude Chabrol, these kind of eminent figures in French and world cinema, were film critics and writers for a long time. Each of them, like François Truffaut, beat Godard with his first film, The 400 Blows, you know, and that kind of put it up to Godard.
You say beat him?
Well, got there first.
Okay, right.
Yeah. But they kind of, this explosion of creativity in the 60s, which kind of copper fastened the image of Gallic chic cool, I think, you know, it's the sunglasses and the gitans and the jump cuts and all that. But it's the restless invention. You ask, why is he so important and so influential? It's that it constantly reinvented. By the end of the 60s, post-1968, he was done with all that.
Yeah, and then went, he was a different filmmaker.
We did a very political film, very unusual filmmaker in the 70s. Then that was changed. In the 80s, something completely different. And this is somebody who's directing films for 60 years.
Yeah.
Like, I saw his last film in the Cannes Film Festival in, 2018, 2019? Yeah. You know, and then he ultimately died by assisted suicide at the age of 92,
I think.
You know, in Switzerland. Yeah. Yeah, he was Swiss. So an extraordinary breadth. And I don't think we'll, like, even putting the season together, there's whole swathes of it here that I will hold my hand up and say that I'm not sure I get this, you know, but taken as a whole, I don't think there's another filmography like it or to match it in its breadth. Like, we'll be studying it for years.
Yeah. You know? So let's start at the beginning. And plenty of people might know Breathless. Why is that such an important film?
Well, it is. It just burst onto the scene with this energy and enthusiasm for, and it's very young. I think cinema up until that point, certainly French cinema, had been quite fusty and quite, you know, for an older audience. This was, I mean, Godard famously said around the time, all you need to make a movie is a girl and a gun. It's on the run. They're young, they're cool.
Guerrilla filmmaking before we had a phrase like
that. Absolutely. Yeah. Very much made on the fly, you know, very DIY, and tossed off with that elan, you know, and let's move on to the next one. And like, his work rate at that point was kind of incredible. It was like two films a year, you know, at least.
And Breathless, from my memory, it's a long time since I saw it, but it's a crime movie of sorts.
They're on the run. We catch up with them kind of post, and you know, people like Quentin Tarantino would take that, you know, with Reservoir Dogs, and you know, you don't see the heist, you see the aftermath, and it's about them hiding out afterwards. Like, so even that is unconventional. And again, you know, we may see, you know, how interesting, but there was probably no budget to shoot the the heist, you know, but often those things, as I said, by accident or design. But yeah, incredibly influential. And as you say, Linklater's film is a very rose-tinted glasses look. It's a gorgeous film. It's really entertaining. And if you've seen the original, which we'll be playing at the IFI on Sunday, the 1st of February, folks, you can then...
We'll come back to Richard Linklater. Yeah. I want to ask you about that. Then in the late 60s, like a lot of the world, I suppose, he becomes very politicized. And, you know, he's nearly a communist, right? Not that that should be a dirty word, but he's very Trotsky and all that stuff.
Very much so. Post-1968... I mean, that's simplistic, but let's say post-1968, he definitely changed. He was involved in this collective called the Zsigmondy Group, where his filmmaking became incredibly politicized and very, very different. I mean, you could say his films in the 60s, again, to be very reductive, they're very entertaining.
Yeah.
Like, these are kind of, you know, they're fun. They're, you know, there's action, there's, you know, there's heists, what have you. The films in the 70s, they're quite oblique. They're very political. He was always engaging with the medium itself, again, if that doesn't sound too lofty, you know, unpicking what a film is. And that got very to the forefront of the filmmaking in the 70s, where it's very self-reflexive. There was very lot of fourth wall breaking and a lot of address to the audience, a lot of sloganeering, but kind of three-dimensional. You weren't just watching a film, you were engaged in a story, but also a political tract, something to be figured out. Not easy watches. These are films that...
Was he whacking you over the head with stuff at the time?
I think he was just so restless and so inventive that it was throwing, and so many, there's like this surfeit of ideas that has been thrown onto the screen, and it's almost kind of move on to the next thing.
Okay.
You know, it's just, there was always onto the next film. Like, while putting the season together, there's 24 films, but there's dozens that, you know, we couldn't fit in. And then there's the short pieces. He did commercials, he did music videos. It's just this constant image making.
Also, in publicity for 20th Century Fox.
That's right, very much at the beginning. So,
he got the commerce of it.
A canny self-pub. Yeah. I mean, all you need to do is look at the guy. Like, I mean, he had the little hat and the sunglasses and the gitane. That was, you know, de rigueur.
Yeah.
You know, that was the style. Like, he was very, very self-aware and very aware of image making, both on the screen, and his own image and his own persona was something that he carried through life. And he reminds me, just as I dove into this season, I was reminded of people like Bob Dylan, you know, who created their own myth, their own mythology. You never quite knew what was real. You couldn't quite separate truth from fiction.
And you're not sure if they even know themselves at the later stages of the career.
They're so kind of embroiled in it now that, you know, they can't untangle it. So, and all the nomic utterances and all that, that's the two figures for me are quite similar.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell me this. So, you know, it's not just French cinema. You mentioned the huge influence, but he had people like Jane Fonda. I mean, All's Well in 1972. You're going to be showing that. My memory is that's a Not that they're not all good, but that's a particularly good one.
Yeah. And I mean, she was a megastar at the time as well. And this, very political. The plot sounds kind of laughable. It is about a journalist getting involved in covering a strike in a sausage factory.
Yes.
Which sounds daft. But the really memorable thing about this is this extraordinary set that he built, which this, you could move from room to room. It was almost like every location in this factory was built in one sort of matrix, and you could, like, the set is a character. It's a thing to behold. It's it's a
and
real
it
selling
all
point.
It takes place in that sausage factory.
Yeah. And Yves Montand, who is a megastar as well.
I want to mention some more films.
Sure.
I gather as well, it's fair to say that he was a complicated fellow, rubbed people up the wrong way. Wasn't there something about he wanted Truffaut to pay for one of his movies?
I said at the beginning, himself and Truffaut were part of this group, and they both worked together, and they were great friends, but had a massive falling out, and they never, for that reason you just stated, he did want him to pay for a film that was going to be like a riposte
to one Truffaut made.
Yeah. And they never repaired that. They never patched things up. I got the impression Goddard could be terribly stubborn and would probably, you know, stick to his guns and things like that, and not be willing to give olive branches.
There's a couple of curiosities in it. Now,
I've
never seen this, and I'd love to. He made King Lear in the 80s.
Well, manage your expectations. You know, this is not...
I already have.
This is not a traditional adaptation. This is not, Shakespeare as we know and love. This is very much an oblique take, a riff, I think, is probably the best way to take it on. It's like a post-apocalyptic world and someone trying to, endeavour to put on a version of King Lear.
Okay.
But again, the flotsam and jetsam of life, Goddard's life, bleed in. Like, this film was funded by Canon Films. I don't know if you know about Canon.
Yeah.
As side note, there's a brilliant documentary about Canon, if you ever, Electric Boogaloo, it's called. And they do focus on this film in that documentary. So there's phone call messages from his producers at Canon are at times played out over the action.
Okay.
So, and that is one thing that, again, we could be here all day, but whatever's happening in Goddard's life bleeds in to the films. Like, if we go back to the 60s, his relationship with Anna Karenina, who was in almost all of his films and in the 60s, and who he was married to for 4 years, his muse, absolutely his muse, then went sour, but he kept her in his films, but his relationship to whatever character she was playing became quite sour as well. So life bled into art every which way you look.
And in King Lear, we can hear phone calls from
his producer of the movie King Lear. Menachem Golan, yeah.
I will manage my expectations, but that is a curiosity I want to see. What was the last movie he made? It was 2018, The Image Book, Livre d'Image.
The last couple of films, The Image Book, and you could probably go back to two or three before that, we're so far from narrative filmmaking. We're in pure essay here. Okay, he was elderly, he was probably housebound. He was just layering images and text and creating... essay films. And I will be frank, some of these are quite difficult to really parse what exactly he's getting at. One of them, Goodbye to Languages in 3D. It'll be the first 3D film we've shown at the IFI in quite a while. Let's hope the tech still works. But they're experiential. Don't go in expecting...
Okay, one for the enthusiasts.
Yeah, I mean, back to that. I mean, Goddard's brilliant for the phrases. Like, he had one great phrase: a film should have a start, middle and an end, though not necessarily in that order.
Yeah.
I mean, these are images that he's, archival pieces, new pieces that he's shuffled. He knows what he's trying to say. And I guess there's a little bit of detective work on the viewer, or just go in and experience it. But
now, we mentioned enthusiasts. Richard Linklater, who was on the show last year, throw that in, why not, is certainly an enthusiast. So his movie, Nouvelle Vogue, is a fictionalized reimagining of the making of Breathless.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an homage to the making of that film. It looks at its kind of, it's on the hoof making on the streets of Paris. It's very affectionate. Mm. It's black and white. It would be unfair to say that it's shot in the style of... I mean, it is quite a straightforward narrative feature. But if you have any affection for that early 60s period, it's delightful.
Okay.
You know, and it's thoroughly... It's not... It doesn't have much of an appetite to criticise.
Right.
Goddard, that's not its... It's not going
He's
there.
He's a fan.
He's such a fan, and it bleeds off the screen. Yeah, it's lovely.
As you clearly are. Look, I hope we've given a sense there, Dave, of how important he is. It's fair to say the influence, you mentioned Tarantino, Scorsese, I would imagine Spielberg to a certain extent as well.
He's the centre of a Venn diagram that just goes in so many different directions. I mean, you can kind of, love him or loathe him, the influence is absolutely not in question.
And then finally, I know you don't want to do this because you're showing 24, but if someone wanted to watch three movies,
yikes.
Breathless would have to be in there.
Yeah, sure. Vive sur Vie is beautiful. That's another one of the early ones. Pierrot Le Fou is terrific. And I am going to say the 3D one, Goodbye to Language. It is extraordinary. If you're looking to take a punt on something, and if I could just quickly, shameless self-promotion, we have two deep dive talks that are going to take place as well. One on the 18th of February, which we have Dr. Douglas Murray, who's going to look at the 60s stuff. And then on Saturday, the 28th of March, Jean-Michel Frodon is coming over from Paris. He writes for Le Monde, and he's going to do a deep dive into the latter half. So if you want to, really get under the hood, we're making it happen.
Well, if you want to talk Goddard, you have to have someone from Le Monde, right?
Absolutely.
What else could you do?
Yeah.
I've been talking to the head of cinema programming, Dave O'Mahony, about their expansive Goddard symposium of sorts, you would say. They're showing 24 movies. It's called 24 Times Per Second. I presume we can get all info ifi.ie, right?
Absolutely right, yeah.
And tickets are on sale from now.
Absolutely right.
Dave, don't leave it so long the next time.
Well, my phone is I'm waiting for that call, John.
Lovely. Dave O'Mahony there, talking about the extensive Jean-Luc Godard Festival that's happening at the IFI. And of course, you can get more info on that at ifi.ie. Now, a world away from Jean-Luc Godard is YouTube, I would suggest. But let's find out, because after the break, I'm going to be talking to a YouTube producer. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, you may have heard the somewhat earth-shattering news that the Ant Beebe, the BBC, are entering a partnership with YouTube, which will not only allow some of your favourite BBC shows to be shown on YouTube, but will also mean that original BBC content is going to appear on YouTube first. And we also heard a couple of weeks ago also that the Oscars from 2028 is going to be shown on YouTube. Is this a good thing? And what does it mean for thousands of content creators out there in the world? And of course, does it mean the death of terrestrial TV? I'm delighted to be joined now by Molly MacDonald, a YouTube producer for the likes of BBC and Red Bull, who's worked on such shows as Saturday Night Live and Billions, and has her own production company, Blue Door Productions. Hi, Molly. How are you?
Hi, John. Very good. Thank you for having me.
Now, old men like me hate the phrase content creators, because it just, content could be anything. So just if you wouldn't mind, dispel that myth or explain what a content creator actually is and why we shouldn't fear it, I guess.
Yeah, of course. I think at its core, content creating refers to just storytelling purely. Mm-hmm. But using new mediums to do so. So we're not reliant on those traditional channels. And I think from a more business perspective, you can talk about content creators that rely on publishing first and partnering later, and building that sort of original format and their own IP.
Right. Now, you've done plenty of content creating. Give us a sense of what you've been doing up until now, because you've literally been all over the world. In Africa, you've been on the set of Saturday Night Live. So what have you been doing with yourself?
Yeah, I think I've had a varied career so far over the last decade in production specifically. So I am essentially the vehicle with which creators can come to and tell their stories through either logistical help or creative partnership. I spent the first 5 years in traditional TV, and then during the pandemic, when all of that sort of halted, I saw an opportunity to work with creators online and to do it a lot faster, to sharpen the process, and just kind of fell in love with what I now call the Wild West of media.
I've heard people describe Hollywood like that at the moment. So is this you helping people make viral videos?
In part, yes, but not always just, viral content. It's also adventure storytelling and topical conversations, podcast content, really anything that you see through TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram.
And presumably this is done with a much lower amount of hardware than a traditional, you know, TV camera rig would need.
Absolutely. Skeleton crews. I mean, most of the time you're, you know, creators that have a million plus subscribers on YouTube, for example, might have a team of two or three people that are doing the production lift. And then on the sort of return, their videos are getting 5 to 10 million views.
Hmm. Fascinating. So tell me this. I want to ask you a bit about your career in a minute, because there were some one or two fascinating things in there. But just in terms of what we're talking about, you know, the BBC using YouTube now in the future, the Oscars being on YouTube. You know, I mentioned the death of traditional terrestrial TV, and maybe that's already happened because of streaming anyway. But like, there are people fearful of this, I suppose, that, you know, suddenly, you know, someone with a phone can be a TV producer in essence. Is this anything to worry about? I'm assume you think not, because this is your career.
I mean, I think I do see both sides of the coin. I think it's a beautiful thing that access is there to be creative and to connect with an audience without having so much red tape in the way. But at the same time, we're in a very strange place where we don't have necessarily the sort of the boundaries and the accountability that we probably should be thinking about at this point. You know, I think all the time about the journalism industry, because that's actually how I started my career as a journalist. And yeah, anyone can report the news and anyone can take videos and share them online and it become, you know, on BBC the next day. I'm just more so thinking about where does the responsibility lie and how do we determine what is verified, trustworthy content when it comes to news or sort of documentary sourcing.
And that's clearly a problem. And we see that in the world now. So, you know, is the fact that some people don't trust YouTube just due to the fact that there isn't enough editorial, you know, hardware around that?
Potentially. I mean, I think it has to do with just how easy it is to make an account and start posting and for something to get picked up by the algorithm.
Yeah.
But I do like the idea that the audience somewhat keeps creators accountable.
Yeah.
It's less about the younger generation for me at the minute and more thinking about, you know, sort of older generations that aren't as connected online and might be scrolling on the likes of Facebook and coming across videos that are, you know, AI or misinformation. That worries me. And at that point, I think we have to look to the platforms themselves to be accountable and responsible for the spread of misinformation.
And tell me this, Russ Cook is this adventure athlete who ran literally the length of Africa. I gather that was something you filmed for, was it Red Bull?
No, actually. So the hardest geezer, as he's known online, so my right hand at Blue Door, Stanley Gaskell, was his project manager. And I joined Russ Cook towards the end of that mission for Algeria and Tunisia to sort of just witness what the team had been doing for the whole year and witness that finish line moment. And to be honest, for me, that was a very big, that wasn't for Red Bull. It was just Russ on his own with a dream and an insane growth over the year that showed me what is really possible when it comes to adventure formats, which isn't something that we had seen up until that point online for whatever reason. It's what led Blue Door to take on Mitch Hutchcraft, who last year was one of our clients who completed a triathlon from England to the top of Mount Everest.
Wow.
We also worked with Johnny Davies as he completed a last man standing race in Texas. I mean, there's these just incredible athletes online, non-traditional athletes who are setting really boundary pushing goals that not only challenge them physically, mentally, but challenge the teams that follow them in terms of covering long-term projects with very small budget and across remote environments. And that is one side of what Blue Door does. It's, you know, high risk, high reward, but it's what I call our passion projects.
Right. And so these, like, so if you film, if your production company films this guy, you know, going from England to Everest or whatever. Where is this shown? It's all entirely online, is it?
All online. Yeah, we started documenting 100 days before the mission on Instagram to do a bit of a momentum push and to show his training. And then once the mission launched, we released a video on YouTube every week or so for the 9 months that he was on the road.
Right. And like, to be mercantile about it, I mean, this is a business. How do you make money out of that?
Yeah, in that case, you know, there's multiple structures. We have obviously production costs that come into play when you have people on the ground and kit and time spent, resources. And that's covered most often by sponsors, commercial brands that resonate with the story or with the creator and want, you know, the exposure that comes with millions of people watching online. But then you also have other sections, sort of IP, which is a huge part of the business now and will continue to be, I hope, as we expand. You know, Mitch is a great example. He's releasing a book about his journey this spring. And he's releasing a documentary, both of which Blue Door has had a part in. So there's definitely other ways of being creative with the streams of income.
Okay. And when you say IP, you mean intellectual property.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay. And tell me this then, like if we go back to the example of the BBC,
it
seems, you know, and I don't want to be old man shouts at cloud here. I'm actually not that old, but, you know, I grew up in the age of, you know, we had six channels where I grew up in Dublin. The idea that, you know, the BBC would make some blinding show with, you know, like the equivalent of the Night Manager or something like that, where they pump a lot of money into it with high production values, and that it would go first and foremost to YouTube. I mean, they've said that's going to happen. Can you see that happening?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there are three distinct points that I see why BBC is heading in that direction. It's the clearest signal yet that legacy broadcasters are conceding distribution power. And that, you know, the main thing is it's not necessarily just about reaching younger audiences anymore, because that ship, I think, sailed a long time ago.
Yes, it's
an admission that the platform really scales and discovers and becomes culturally relevant on its own. For the industry, it validates YouTube isn't just a secondary outlet. It's a primary broadcaster with a real reach that even BBC can't touch at the minute. And it also really collapses this like hierarchy between broadcast and creator. Creators create original formats and reach their audiences directly. They don't need, you know, a channel to get there anymore. And it really does blur the line between proper television and internet content. But this is like a hybrid sort of social first approach, just like what Blue Door does. We're a social first production company. We're interested in creating stories that reach audiences very closely, intimately, you know, at their bedside tables or in their living rooms, and where they can have a direct conversation with us and the creators and give us feedback immediately.
Yeah. It's a brave new world. Tell me this, can you see a time where movies are made specifically for YouTube or other video platforms? Because that would terrify me as a lover of the darkened room where we all communally watch.
Yeah. And likewise, I mean, I'm absolutely cinephile. That's what, you know, why I got into the industry myself. I grew up watching films with my family and still do to this day. However, what it comes down to is affordability. And just like we're seeing, you know, people are leaving LA en masse to make films in other places, both in the States and abroad. I think it's only a matter of time before we see real feature pieces. And the Oscars being distributed on YouTube is a sign that they know very shortly they'll have to be shooting. Like they're going to have to probably reevaluate the films that enter the Oscars and how they enter, how they become, you know, available to audiences. It's not just going to be through sitting in cinemas.
a couple of years ago, streamers were allowed to be included. But I think we're way past that now, where YouTube may have to be included. And then finally, I suppose the Oscars is a very interesting example. The fact that they're going to YouTube in 2028, because I love the Oscars, but if I'm being honest about it, you know, I probably watch it live for the job I have, but most people are consuming it the next day in 90-second clips, be it a great speech or a bad speech or Will Smith smacking Chris Rock. I mean, to me, it seems the Oscars has nearly entirely become a digital thing.
Yeah, I would say so. I think it gives people the option to watch when they're ready and when it's convenient for them. I mean, I live primarily in London, and I don't really want to stay up, you know, all hours until the program is over. So in the morning, it's the first thing I can do. And that is really helpful. That flexibility means a lot.
Absolutely. And tell me this just finally then, Blue Door Productions, what can we look forward to seeing online or elsewhere in the future?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, it's a lot that I can't talk about, but certainly a lot that I can as well. We're partnering with Red Bull this next year, which is very exciting to do more big projects with them and just more extreme stunts. We've got some new creators who are launching really exciting platforms, banding together with existing creators to push what YouTubers are already consuming and to hopefully bridge into larger markets. So from the UK to the US, we'll be doing a lot with influencers and creators at that level. And then keep an eye out for some amazing physical challenges that we'll be documenting, much like the Hardest Geezer or like Mitch Hutchcraft. Dare I say, even larger scale.
Okay, now you haven't actually told me anything there. So can you tell me what some of these physical activities are?
I'm not able to share until we go public, unfortunately.
Okay.
Because I don't want to take the momentum away from when we actually release the vid, but you can be sure I'll be sharing it online.
No doubt you will. Where else? And tell me this finally, Molly MacDonald, that sounds as Irish as I don't know what. There must be some Irish there.
Mom and Dad grew up in Ireland, and I've spent a lot of time over there in Dublin and Galway.
Well, that was Molly MacDonald, YouTube producer, creator of the company Blue Door Productions. It is a scary but brave and fascinating new world. Molly, fascinating to talk to you. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much, John.
YouTube producer Molly MacDonald there, talking to me about, well, YouTube and its place in the future of your viewing habits. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, I'll be talking to the cast of the new Lisa McGee series, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, including the great Roisin Gallagher. If you want to get in touch, you can email screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your long bank holiday weekend, and I will talk to you all next week.